Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, March 18th, 2007, on the premier radio networks, including many local talk stations all over the country and XM Satellite Channel 152. This is show number 336.
Okay, you're up.
And a very good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. It's time to talk tech from now. For the next couple of hours, we're going to have a great time, and I want you to take part. Here's the number, 8888, Ask Leo, 888-827-5536. Say hi to Rebecca Baker. And if you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, maybe you were in a store and you saw something interesting and you want to know more about it, whether it's a GPS or a camcorder, a cell phone, or a 5.1 speaker system. That's what we talk about on the show. Computers, too, and the internet, and all that stuff. If it's got a chip in it, that's what we talk about. 8888, Ask Leo. My son, Henry, 12 years old, driving me crazy last night, playing Line Rider. Do you know about Line Rider? It's all over the internet. It's the silliest little game you ever saw. Written in Flash, I guess. And it looks like it was written by somebody in Eastern Europe. The official site, it's official-linerider.com. But if you do a Google for Line Rider, oh boy, you'll find a bunch of them. It is the silliest little game in the world. Couldn't be easier. You've got a pencil. You draw a line. I guess, for want of a better word, it's a ski slope. And then you press play, and a little guy in a bicycle, or a sled, I guess, rides the line. And if you don't do so well, he doesn't go very far. And the trick is to get him to go for as long as possible. Boy, that sounds like a simple conception, and yet there's something about it. It's just, whoops, I'm playing it right now. I'm sorry. I probably should concentrate on the show, shouldn't I? It's addictive. You can't stop playing it. And it's interesting because Henry has, you know, we have Xbox 360 and Xbox, and we have plenty of high-end gaming systems. And yet he can't stop playing this simple little game. I mean, you couldn't make it more simple. And it just shows you that what makes a good game is not necessarily stunningly realistic 3D graphics or super-duper weapons or high-speed adventures. It can be something as simple as just a brain teaser. And it's just as compelling to these kids and grown-ups, too. Flash games are very big right now. I'm wondering if you'd like to share your favorite Flash game with us. Your favorite online game, 8888-ASK-LEO. Or maybe your longest Line Rider time. Or if there's something better than Line Rider, 8888-ASK-LEO. There's just something about these games I find fascinating. And you know, when the production of a major game for an Xbox 360 or a Nintendo Wii or a Sony PlayStation 3 costs tens of millions of dollars, takes 1, 2, 3 years to develop. Downstairs from the Leoville Labs, there's a company developing an adventure game. I'm not sure how much I could tell you about it. They're really great people. They're developing this great game. It's neat looking. It's going to take him at least a year, maybe 2, 10 people working full time. And I bet you this Line Rider is written by one guy in his spare time. And which will get more hours of play? I don't know. It's really, gaming is very interesting because it really is about fun, ultimately. And we talk a lot about how, wow, you know, and in fact, I've talked about it in past weeks. Any day now, you're going to see games that are as real as life, real life. You know, people now already spend 8 hours, 10 hours a day playing World of Warcraft or hanging out in Second Life, these virtual reality worlds. They've become their real life. Second Life, heck, it's their first life. And they're not even very vividly realistic. And I often wonder, boy, if they got really real. I mean, if they really seemed like real life, what's to keep us from spending almost every waking hour there? Well, I guess the problem of food and sleep. But for a lot of people, you know, there are stories. I don't know if they're real. Of people in South Korea, this stuff is huge in South Korea, especially this online role-playing games. That's what they call things like World of Warcraft. They actually, technically, the technical term is MMORPG, Massively Multiplayer Online Role-Playing Games. Morberg. What a terrible name. But that's what these are. You're playing with hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of other people online in a world at the same time, sometimes just chatting, sometimes actually actively going on quests, and they're very compelling, they're very realistic, and they tell the stories in South Korea where these games are very big and high-speed internet is almost ubiquitous of people actually dying because they forgot to eat or go to the bathroom or sleep. It's hard to confirm these. But certainly, I think there's no doubt that people do, you know, push it pretty hard. They get very addictive with this stuff. Do you know somebody like that who can't stop playing World of Warcraft? I'm going to raise my hand because I have a little problem with that. I'm working on it. I could stop any time. You know what's compelling about World of Warcraft? And I think any good game, and I think Line Rider as well. And I think good game designers know this. There has to be this series of, it's what they call operant conditioning, these series of rewards spaced just right, not too close together, but not too far apart either, so that you get just the right hit. And it's a pleasure center when you get these rewards. And it's just like gambling. It has to come just at the right time and just sufficiently. Not so often that it's too easy and you don't get that hit, but often enough so that you want to, five more minutes. And I watch my son, and he says that even with his Line Rider. Five more minutes, please. I got to play one more time. And Line Rider's like that because you draw the line, you create the path, you send this line stick figure on a sled down it. And it's just, it's very satisfying when it works. And then it just, something a little goes wrong. Oh, I could fix that. Just a little more. Oh, it's getting better. And it drags you into it. With World of Warcraft, it's what they call the drops that suck you in. For those who haven't played World of Warcraft, it is a fantasy world populated by orcs and elves and all sorts of fantastic creatures. You choose one of these creatures. You become one of them. You go on quests either by yourself or with others in groups, you know, slaying monsters, finding treasure, rescuing damsels in distress. But none of that, I mean, some of that's good. And of course, one of the ways they keep you going is as you do this, you gain experience points. And when you gain a certain number of experience points, you go to the next level. There are 70 levels in all. Used to be 60. They just upgraded to 70 levels in all. And so initially what you're doing is you're trying to, what they call, level up, get to the next level, get to the next level. But I think it's the drops that's the secret of these games. And this company, Blizzard, that makes World of Warcraft, is the king of this. The drops are what you get. The items that the monsters or the bad guys have that you get when you slay them. The things they drop. And there are a variety, thousands of different kinds of drops, but some of them are extra special good. they're magical treasures. And I think that is the secret of World of Warcraft, because they can time those very well, right? Just as you're starting to get, I'm sick, I gotta stop. A guy will drop the royal beaver coat mail of honor from King John II, and you go, whoa, I got it, wow. And then, of course, you have to earn the right to wear it. You may not be a sufficiently developed character to wear it. So then you have to fight on so that you can wear it, or you have to take it to the auction house and find some sucker to buy it, or you could see how these become very engrossing. And yet, for all the effort and time and trouble and work they put into a game like World of Warcraft, a game like Line Rider could be just as compelling. There's a new game coming up from the king of simulations. His name is Will Wright. He did The Sims, Sim City. He's been doing Sims for a long time. And really, World of Warcraft and Second Life are very much inspired by these things. His next game is due out sometime this year. And there's an immense amount of buzz about it. It's called Spore, S-P-O-R-E. You can look at it at spore.com. Will's been very clever, as befits a good game designer, at slowly rolling out details so you can find out more about it. But here is why I think Spore is going to end up being a game that's going to suck the best minds of our generation completely dry. It starts at the very beginning with single cell creatures, and you work with these creatures. You build up characteristics. You can decide they have two legs, three legs, eight legs, and it's all determined by their destiny is determined by what you decide, and they evolve up into civilizations, eventually go into space, and you're there the whole time, directing. You're God, aren't you, on these games? You create from the beginning and you build this up. And then, I'm not really clear on this. They haven't been very clear about how this works. Somehow your characters interact with other people's characters online. You're not exactly playing other people, but worlds collide, worlds intersect. Many adults poo-poo this. I'm not a gamer. I got a life. I don't have time to do this. That's only because they haven't been sucked in yet. You ever play Tetris, Solitaire on your Windows machine? Line Rider, let's hear what your favorite game is. Tell us your secret shame. How many hours did you spend last night playing World of Warcraft? I only spent an hour. I'm proud of myself. I could stop any time, I told you. 88 Ask Leo is the number. 888-827-5536. Our chat room is live and happening right now. Join Dan and Dustin, Illuminati, Shuby, and irc.dslextreme.com. That's a website, and you can join us through that, or you can use your chat client, your IRC 20 client. 20 seconds. Line. That is, again, irc.dslextreme.com. And Shuby's also taking the show notes, and we'll have lots of those for you at techguylabs.com. Coming up, lots of great stuff. We're going to talk about a new Amazon thing called the Mechanical Turk. A look at home theater with Scott Wilkinson and your calls to 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy, and the wind cries geek. Leo Laporte taking your calls at 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking about high tech, anything with a chip in it. I just got a swell new high def camcorder. It is not what you would think. It is not an expensive Sony. It is not a big fancy Canon. It's an Exacti. It's a little recorder that goes to a solid-state flash, and I want to give it more time to review, but so far, very impressed. I like the earlier version of this. It's the new HD2. Ooh. We'll talk about that later. Let's go to line one, though. Steve's on the line from Long Beach. Hello, Steve. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, Leo. My question, I want to add a second monitor to my computer, but I looked on the back, and I've got no port for that. So.
Right.
How difficult is it, and what do I need to do?
A couple of different ways to go. You can, of course, go out and buy a new video card that has two heads. A lot of these do. This is very common now. You could go out and buy a second video card. That's less good these days. You have a fairly recent machine. Does it have...
It's XP Pro.
But the question is, is the motherboard AGP or PCI Express?
Boy, I don't
yeah.
know.
So the problem with... adding another card is you usually only have one video card slot in most machines nowadays. So the second card will have to be PCI. I would take a look at Matrox has an interesting solution. It's a little dongle that comes off of a standard video card and lets you use two screens. It's called their dual head to go. And they actually have a triple head to go. Now, I haven't tried it. It's Matrox. A number of people emailed me. Because somebody was asking the same question for a Mac Mini, and I said, well, you can't do it with a Mini because there's no upgradability. But they said they've used it, and it works. It's a splitter, because it allows you to expand the displays up to 3840 by 1200. So that's the equivalent of a two 1920 by 1200 displays. So that would work on those, for instance, Dell widescreen displays.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how they... I'm not sure how they do this. It should work with a notebook. It should work with a desktop. They have digital and analog, so you can come off a DVI port or a VGA port. I suspect that they're basing this on the fact that most video cards can support much larger resolutions than they actually are supporting on a single monitor. So this just makes it look like
Is there a way for me to check that within my computer to where I can just accept a second card, or I just...
It's not a second card. This isn't a card. That's what I like about this. That's why it works with a laptop or a mini. It's a box that connects to your single video card, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes to that box, and then the box has two output ports, one for each monitor.
And it can figure out what's what then.
Yeah, and it splits them. It does. You know, there's two ways to do multiple monitors. There's mirroring, and that you use that to do PowerPoint. So you see the same thing on your screen as you'd see on the second screen. You don't want that. You want to extend.
Yeah.
You want an extended desktop where you have a double wide, Art Bell would like this, a double wide desktop. And that's what this, in theory, does. Now, I would read the, go to Matrox.com and read the compatibility descriptions of what kind of cards it works with and so forth. But I've been told by a number of people this works pretty well. What it is that you have to have a system, a video card. You probably don't know this. You could find out in your hardware device manager how much RAM is in your video card, video RAM.
Okay.
You'd probably need, I'm going to say you're going to need at least 128 megs of video RAM. If you have more, then it's almost no sweat. It will absolutely work.
Okay.
The amount of RAM tells you how much resolution you can display.
My applications for this, I'm a dentist, so I
great.
Want to pull up pictures I take.
Sure you do.
Everything on my, I'm chartless, so everything's digital now, and I'll run, besides my program for my office, I also do present, I'm pulling up pictures,
right.
Doing some Kodak stuff and also word processing, but I like to keep if I'm working on one patient, I want to be able to open up a multiple different screens and look at it all at the same time.
Now, you're not playing Tetris.
Open, close, open.
You're not playing Tetris while you're doing root canals here.
No, actually, I will do solitaire. That would be solitaire is or hearts is really my
hearts is
my
fun.
Achilles heel. Hearts is the biggie.
You play the hearts online?
Yeah, I'm a master hearts player.
Oh, what fun!
Take them all down.
Do you get decent competition online when you play hearts online?
But see what happens is once you start dominating, everyone leaves.
He's too good. So give us a tip because I like hearts. I love spades. I play them both kind of interchangeably. Give us how do you become such a great hearts player? Lots of games, I guess.
Too much time playing. It's
hey, there's
a direct relationship.
There's downtime. You know, the gotta let the bond dry, stuff like that. There's downtime.
Sure.
There's plenty of time in the dental office where you could get a couple of games in.
Well, at least during lunch.
All right, Steve.
My 5 minutes.
Hey, it's great to talk to you. I think that will work. But again, check to make sure you have enough video card. The whole idea of this is it tells the computer, you've got a big screen. And as long as your video card can handle a big screen, it's gonna work just fine. And as I said, I'm always cautious. And I want to be first to tell you, I haven't tried it. I'll get a unit and try it. But I've talked to people who haven't say it works quite well. Matrox dual head to go, matrox.com. Coming up, Amazon's doing some amazing stuff. They don't just sell books or kids' toys. They it's not just selling. They do some amazing, they have a service called S3 that allows you to store data very inexpensively, gigabytes of data on their system. And they also have something called the Mechanical Turk that a number of companies are using to do some very interesting things. Rick Albert comes up in just a few minutes to tell us about the latest from Amazon, the Mechanical Turk. You stay here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, Rick.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
You're up.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California. This is the show where every single week we talk about what's happening in the world of technology. And, you know, it's hard to stop with just one thing. There's so many exciting things going on. It's hard to even pick one. That's Rick's job. Rick Alber is a guy who's been covering this stuff, working in the industry, doing it for years. And he's kind of a man about Web 2.0, I would guess is the best way to describe him. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Leo. Yeah, I'm kind of a man about the net, just toiling away, looking for interesting stuff to talk about.
Today we're going to talk about, and I mentioned this earlier, the Amazon Mechanical Turk. Now, the name is a little resonant. I did a lecture on a cruise a couple of months ago about the history of chess-playing machines, and the very first chess-playing machine was a Mechanical Turk that appeared to play very good chess. This was back in the 1770.
Yeah. Wolfgang Kempelen was the purveyor of the Mechanical Turk back then.
Turned out to be kind of a scam. There was a guy inside.
Yeah, a little guy was hiding inside, of course. This was about 200 years before IBM's Deep Blue. So
right, they really couldn't play good chess in the 1770s. So we fast forward to the 21st century, and Amazon has a service called the Mechanical Turk. Is there a little guy inside?
No, there's actually thousands and thousands of little guys and little girls, I guess, around the world that are participating in Amazon's Mechanical Turk service.
What is it?
You mentioned earlier, just to kind of give the right context, you mentioned earlier that Amazon offers some unique web services, S3 for kind of hosted storage on demand, and a thing called EC2, which is sort of their computing power on demand that businesses can subscribe to and use these services on the fly, programmatically, to accomplish whatever tasks they need. But of course, what they're connecting to at the Amazon center is giant computers that Amazon maintains. Now, Amazon in late 2005 released or announced this new service called the Mechanical Turk, and it's not quite the same. What the Mechanical Turk does is it provides a way to harness human intelligence or human judgment to do tasks that are difficult or you know, impossible for computers to do.
This sounds a little bit like Yahoo has a Yahoo Answers service, where instead of using the search engine, you're actually asking an expert for an answer. In fact, Stephen Hawking very famously asked a question on there, and he's got a lot of stupid answers. And Google had a similar service, which they recently discontinued. Is this the same kind of thing?
Well, it can be. The way it's set up is you can present or submit what Amazon refers to as HITs, or human intelligent tasks. And your task that you submit to the service is then presented on a website, and it can be browsed by anybody in the world who wants to go to the website, take a look at the tasks, and when you submit it, you set a price, what you will pay for the successful completion of that task, and anybody in the world can accept the task, do it, submit the answer to you, and if they do it correctly, if they meet your criteria, then you pay them.
So
they get paid.
It's not just research, though. It's programming. It could be any task, right?
Yeah, right. It's used for research, certainly. But what it's proven to be real practical for is kind of small little funny tasks that computers can't do, like categorizing pictures, for instance, or identifying specific items in images that a geospatial company needs to pick out of pictures.
So it's really just like an outsourcing service, but for jobs that are really almost too small to actually hire somebody to do.
That's right. And the fact that anybody in the world can pick up one of these hits and do it means that you've got the entire globe as your resource pool of people. And so a lot of the tasks go for very small amounts of money, like a penny or 5 cents or maybe a dollar for something that might take a few minutes to do. And so far as they can tell, the people that participate in the Mechanical Turk and do the tasks are stay-at-home, you know, folks that maybe are taking care of kids or spend their day watching television and want something to do to make a little money or end the boredom that they're experiencing.
Are they mostly in the U.S. or are they? I mean, where are these people coming from? Are there a lot of people in India, for instance, doing this?
Amazon wouldn't tell me that when I interviewed the product manager from Mechanical Turk. He just said that they've got people participating from over 100 countries.
Wow.
And there's literally thousands.
It does kind of flatten the, you know, it's like Thomas Friedman talks about in The World is Flat. It really flattens the global economy because, frankly, if there's a guy in India willing to do the same job just as well for a penny as a person in the U.S. is willing to do for $5, you're going to go with a guy who doesn't for a penny.
Exactly. Some of the tasks up there, like I said, are very simple, kind of mundane things. Like one of the tasks for, I think, a nickel, you have to look at about 20 different pictures of roads taken, you know, from like a car windshield. And you need to tag those pictures at the point of the picture where you see a little drainage hole. That's the whole task. You look at 20 of those, you get paid a nickel after you've completed it properly. And when you submit your answer back, of course, it'll be passed on to somebody else who will be paid maybe 3 cents to check your answer. And then maybe another guy will be paid 2 cents to take those answers and put them in a database.
Wow.
It's all very, you know, mechanical and much like its name, it's using people as the mechanical components in a process to get something done.
This is such a wild idea, and there's so many questions that come up. First of all, do you think you can make a decent living as a Turk, as a guy doing the work?
I don't think so, unless you happen to live in a hut in Samoa, you know, where
so
your cost of living is about. But a lot of people, you know, the motivation for doing it is a little bit unclear. Certainly, you know, people kind of get hooked on
being the know-it-all,
the challenge of it.
Yeah,
and it's interesting to think that when you see a hit up there, you're going to be in a sense bidding to do it against a guy who may be. You know, running a $50 computer in a in a village in, you know, the third world.
You know, I know I have a few friends who are radiologists. They read x-rays in hospitals, and more and more that job is being farmed out to radiologists. I mean, they're still physicians, but in India and other countries where the pay scale is much lower, is that kind of highly specialized work also being done on the Turk?
I would certainly speculate that it is, mainly because any task in which you can pass the guts of the task, the important parts of it digitally, you know, through the internet around the world, then it works in the Mechanical Turk model. And importantly, you can pass the same radiology slide
to five
different people.
Again, five four different readings, yeah, because it's cheap.
If four of them agree on a particular reading, you can have a pretty good, you know, sense that that's probably the right result.
Oh, that's interesting, too. You can, of course, you could have multiple people do the same job and then kind of combine the answers. Why is Amazon doing this? What is, I mean, really, I think of them as a bookstore. How'd they get in this business?
Well, Amazon is one of the leading companies in what I think is the most fascinating part of the web right now, and that's delivering the web as a platform for computing. And Amazon, while they've expanded obviously to sell nearly everything in the world, they're making a really big push through the S3 service we talked about and EC2 and things like the Mechanical Turk to give new companies or new organizations that think of a good idea but don't want to run out and buy all the equipment and hardware and undertake the maintenance and find people to deal with the nuts and bolts of computing. Amazon wants to be the place that they turn to for computing services delivered like a utility. Wow. Over the line, you know, right into your office or your home, and give you the access to an immense amount of computing resources. And a lot of people think that's really the future of the internet, and Amazon is real smart to go in that direction.
Can an individual use it? I mean, can I just go on there? Do I have to kind of create a elaborate account? I mean, how hard is it for me to use as a querier?
Well, you can go right to Mechanical Turk and in 35 seconds sign up as a Turk to do one of the hits or to submit a hit. That's very easy to do.
What is the URL?
It is www.mturk.com.
Oh, that's easy.
Now, some of the tasks might require that you be qualified, and you might have to take a test or work through some of the sample hits before you actually get paid.
You can't just say you're a radiologist. You actually have to demonstrate the ability.
Right. You can claim to be one on television and then prove that you actually are.
Well, I complain. I pretend to be a computer expert on television. Rick, it's great to talk to you in a fast. That's two in a row now. Amazing finds. Keep it up. I love it.
Well, I'll be looking this week and talk to you next week, Leo. Right,
thank you. Rick Alber on The Tech Guy. Let's see. We have a time for another call here. Let's go to Bill in Santa Monica. Hello, Bill. Line 3, Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy.
Hello?
Hey, Bill.
We're back. Okay. Quick question. My nephew borrowed my computer, and now I have this awful thing called Mirar, M-I-R-A-R, where the toolbar is. And I can't seem to get rid of it. And it's causing a lot of problems because my daughter will go on like the Barbie.com website. And yeah. When she does, in those related search boxes, it goes into like sex sites and stuff.
Right. It's spyware. Your nephew did a good job. He got some spyware on your system.
Terrific.
Now, if you go, there are places where you can get Mirar removal instructions. spywareremove.com has a little program that you run. But I have to tell you, the real problem with removing spyware is the stuff changes rapidly. There's it's very lucrative for the guys who do Mirar, and they really make money, and they really don't want you to get rid of it. So they constantly change it. So removal instructions don't always work. Symantec also has removal instructions at sarc.com. But I'll be honest, it's very hard to remove spyware.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Try these instructions. SpyroRemove.com and SARC.com, and cross your fingers. But if it keeps coming back, and this is often the case with spyware, ultimately you've got to, I'm sorry to say, remove Windows and reinstall, format and reinstall. When you lend to your nephew, you take your life in your hands. I thank you for the call. I'm sorry for the bad news. Spyware is a problem. It really is. More of your calls coming up at 8888-ASK-LEO. I am Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy, talking about high tech today and every week at this time on this great radio station. Hey, we had talked a couple of weeks ago with Rick Alber about the Times Reader, and I just thought it was so cool. The New York Times put out a reader that let you really read an electronic edition of the Times. It was very much like reading the real Times. The graphics, the ads, of course, is why they do it, right? And everything. And I thought, this is great. This is the first application I've seen that would maybe make me want to read a newspaper online. My misgivings were, well, if the Times does their proprietary reader, and then, you know, the Wall Street Journal does theirs, and the San Jose Mercury News does theirs, and the Washington Post does theirs, and, well, pretty soon you've got 50 different applications on your desktop, and that's really not what the web is about. The web is about standards so that we can use one application to read all of these, and certainly the New York Times could have done that. They could have made a browser-based application that would work without downloading their application. Well, they made another misstep, I think. I launched the New York Times reader this morning. They said the beta is about to stop. It's about to be over. And Rick tells me that the Times plans to charge, get this, $16 a month to use the New York Times reader. Now that you get the Times Select, which is their subscription service, it gives you access to the old stories. Times, like many newspapers, makes the new stories free, but the old backstories you have to pay for. And if you pay $10 a month for Times Select, you can do that. If you pay an additional $6, you get the Times Select and the reader. But that's the only way to get the reader, $16 a month. Well, forget it. I'm sorry, but forget it. Now, some will say, and I'm sure the Times management says, well, that's still a lot cheaper than the paper newspaper. I guess so, but I'll just read it on the web. Thank you very much. I'm not going to spend that kind of money per month to read one newspaper. And I'll be very interested. I think this is going to flop. It's a shame because it's a neat program, but I think it's going to flop. I think the Times has made a mistake here. They said, their publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, said a few months ago that he predicted in the next decade that the New York Times would stop printing paper versions entirely. They'd go all online. And obviously this is what, you know, the kind of thing they're looking at. There are advantages to doing it in their own application. You can't copy and paste stuff out of it. You can't not read the commercials. See, with a browser, you can always get rid of the ads. Well, I think this is going in the wrong direction, frankly. Proprietary closed systems, that's the old days. That's not the future. We'll see what happens, but I suspect they've just killed that service by saying we're going to charge $16 for it. That's ridiculous. Let's go to line one. Tim in San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Leo. I have a coffee house where I'm offering, for the moment, I've got a free Wi-Fi internet connection.
I love you. That's great.
And I'm going to keep it free. But what I do want to do is set it up in a way, an easy solution, to have a splash page when people access my connection with a area to put in a password, which I can change every day if I want to and have it printed on a receipt. So I can have my customers using my free Wi-Fi and not some guy sitting in a car outside the cafe sucking up all my bandwidth.
You bet.
I wonder, is there a solution that's easy and inexpensive for me to use? I've seen some on the web that you kind of go through an existing website, someone else's website.
No, don't do that.
I don't want it. I want to control it myself.
You need a Linksys WRT54G router. And the reason I say that is these are the most hackable routers and the most hacked routers out there. They're cheap. They're plentiful. The WRT54G, you may already be using one. It is probably the number one Wi-Fi router out there. And then what you do is you're going to install this is so great. This router has been so hacked. You're going to install a thing called OpenWRT, which completely changes the firmware of this. It actually puts Linux on it. I think Linux may already be on it. It modifies it so that you can now configure this to do what you want. And there are a number of different programs that you could put on there that will do exactly this, to make a community Wi-Fi service. You can even have it charge. There's all sorts of things you can do with it. I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you on howtoforge.com. There's an article. I'll put this in the show notes on setting up your own Wi-Fi hotspot that talk about the different programs. Now, you have to be a little bit of a hacker, but if you follow the instructions, it's pretty straightforward. And you will find that there are a number of other programs like this that modify widely available commercial routers to turn them into hotspots or turn them into community Wi-Fi centers that don't charge but kind of have a splash page. There are a number of community Wi-Fi, started I think in Toronto, number of community Wi-Fi systems, maybe Seattle, where you log on to what looks like an open access port and you get a splash page that says, welcome to our neighborhood router. And they have forums, they have chat groups, they have all this neighborhood stuff. It's a really great idea. Now, you have a little bit more need than that. I mean, that would get you the splash page. But if you want to also keep track of usage, then you're going to need basically a setup that is designed to charge people. You just charge them zero.
Right.
And then that way you can
allow me to control kind of what they're accessing to some degree to make sure they're not hitting inappropriate sites inside the cafe.
You know, probably what you're going to want to do is not do that. This has some of those capabilities, but probably what you're going to want to do is use another device, like say the iBoss, which is a hardware device, IBOSS, to filter what they're doing. And I would do that as a separate device that it goes through after it goes through the. It goes to the cable modem, to the iBoss, to the router. And then that will give you absolute control over everything. What they can do, you can even say, hey, no chatting allowed between 4 and 6 because that's open mic night. I mean, you can have absolute control over it. All these solutions are out there. It takes a little bit. You have to be a little bit. Are you a little bit of a geek? A little bit of a hacker, Tim? You're going to be. Okay.
Yeah, I can do okay. You know, to be honest with you, I've already got my Wi-Fi running. I've got a business connection through AT&T.
Great.
And I have one of these combination router modems.
Yeah. So just so what you'll continue to use that, but what you'll have is that router will go out and get a cheap WRT54G, hack that, And it'll go through that, and that'll be the Wi-Fi. You disable the Wi-Fi on the modem, and then you use that. It'll work great. It's a really neat little hack. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy, our gadget guru. Coming up in a little bit, Ron Rosberg. More of your calls, too, at 888 Ask Leo. I am the tech guy. Tech Guy Labs, where the future is here now. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. 888-ASK-LEO is the number. 888-8. Actually, it's 888-827-5536. Don't want to give you too many eights there. 888-827-5536. We're talking about crazy games online and how much time you spend. Also, the big story of the week, Viacom doing a little Dr. Evil thing and suing YouTube for $1 billion. Actually, Viacom's yearly revenue is only $1.6 billion, so it would be a significant increase to their bottom line if they were to win this lawsuit. But it's an important lawsuit, not just for YouTube and not just for Viacom, but I think for a lot of sites, and it could put, some people think, could put YouTube out of business. Here's what the judge has to decide. Viacom says Google is posting tens of thousands of copyrighted clips, actually 150,000 copyrighted clips that have been viewed 1.5 billion times and have made Google lots of money on YouTube. And they say, even though we keep asking YouTube to pull those clips down, people keep uploading them. And we want damages. They say Google should be responsible. I use Google and YouTube interchangeably. That's probably confusing. Google owns YouTube. I'll just stick with YouTube. They say YouTube should be responsible for seeing if there are copyrighted clips and pulling them down. YouTube says, wait a minute, we can't do that. Millions of clips are uploaded every single day. What are we supposed to go through each one? And how do we know if they're copyrighted? We can't tell. Maybe Viacom uploaded them. We don't know. You can't look at a clip and know off the top if it's copyrighted or not. Actually, everything's copyrighted. That's just the by default. It's not really whether it's copyrighted, but whether the copyright holder doesn't want you to put it up or not. They can't. They said we can't be responsible for that. We have complied with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's the law of the land in the United States. The DMCA says a copyright holder should be able to request that a copyrighted clip be pulled down, and it should be pulled down promptly. But that's the only responsibility that a web hosting company has. Ah, but here's the important part. Is YouTube a web hosting company? Viacom says, no, they're not a web hosting company. They should be responsible for the content because they're making money on the content. YouTube says, no, we're just like AOL or anybody else. The Copyright Act was very specifically written to protect companies like AOL, saying, look, they can't be held responsible for copyright violations. There's too much to monitor, too much to police. A message board can't be held responsible for whether there's copyright violation on there. All they have to do is this, it's called the safe harbor provision. All they have to do is provide an easy way for a copyright holder to request that stuff be taken off and then do it. Google says we're complying with the law. Is Google an internet service provider, a web hosting company, or is it a media company? Is YouTube a media company? That's the question. Now, the courts will ultimately have to decide this, and it's a tricky thing to decide. If the courts say, no, YouTube is a media company, like NBC or CBS, they make money on clips, and they're knowingly making money on copyrighted clips. If they should decide that, that's the end of the line for YouTube. They'll appeal. It could take a long time, but that is the death knell for YouTube. And all those services similar, and there are lots of them. if YouTube prevails, then I think you'll see a tough time for copyright holders because, as Viacom points out, it's like whack-a-mole. As soon as we get one pulled down, 20 more spring up. People are adamant about getting their, you know, material. Now, Viacom does MTV, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon. Is it Nickelodeon? They do a bunch of different cable networks. Mostly it's Comedy Central stuff. And The Late Show. They own CBS. It's the Late Show clips are up there. And The Late Late Show. Now, I have to say, I had never heard of The Late Late Show until I saw it on YouTube. I think YouTube put Saturday Night Live back on the map by putting, you know, illegal clips. NBC said, well, you can take those clips down. And then realized, wait a minute, we got more people watching Saturday Night Live because of the clips on YouTube. Isn't it in Viacom's interest? Some say that's all Viacom's trying to do is strong arm a better deal out of YouTube. They want to share revenues. They don't really want YouTube to go out of business. And I think I agree. If this is Viacom's attempt to put YouTube out of business, as the record industry put Napster out of business some years ago, then this is highly misguided. YouTube is the best thing that has happened to the television networks ever. And I'll tell you, most people don't go on YouTube and watch a whole show. They're looking for short clips. They're promotional. They have promotional value. I watch how my kids use YouTube. I'll see a lot of clips from Saturday Night Live, and it makes me want to watch the show. It's good for the show. That's what, in fact, YouTube is saying. How do you prove that anybody's watching these long-form things? They're watching 10 seconds or 10 minutes. They're not watching the whole show. So this will be a very interesting battle. Remember, Napster was put out of business by Metallica and the recording industry, who said to Napster, look, you are required to monitor for copyright violations and take them down. It's your job. And the judge agreed. The judge said, Napster, you need to come up with a technology that makes sure that no pirated music is on your service. When Napster failed to do it, and they said, we can't, it's too hard to do. When they failed to do it, the judge shut them down, put them out of business. I'd hate to see that happen to YouTube, but that's what's at stake here. It's not $1 billion. The $1 billion is nothing. It is something. It's not the important issue here. And I don't even know if Viacom wants $1 billion. Like, it's just as likely Viacom wants a better sweet deal with YouTube. They walked away from the table with YouTube a few months ago, went to a company called Juice and said, they're going to pay us for our stuff. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my phone number. I'd love to talk to you about this or anything. What do you think? Is YouTube responsible for copyright violations that occur on YouTube? How do you monitor? I can't remember by the number, but it's hundreds of thousands of videos, new videos every day. How do you monitor those? Last month, Viacom requested that Google remove 100,000 clips. 100,000 clips. Some of which apparently weren't even Viacom's. That's the problem, is the volume of this stuff makes it almost impossible to get the job done. We got to find another way. If Viacom is losing money, and I don't think they are, but if they're losing money to this, then they got to find another way to make money, because this is going to happen. No, even if YouTube goes out of business, this is going to happen. Let's go to line three, Michelle in Oxnard. Hello, Michelle. Welcome, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hi.
I currently have three websites that are doing quite well, and I would like to do a little traveling this summer and still stay in touch. Now, last year when I traveled, I made use of Bluetooth, and it was a little less than satisfactory.
It was slow, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, you're using your cell phone as your internet provider.
Correct.
Where are you going?
It'll be in the States, probably mostly the western states, and I'm going to try and stay in places where there's larger cities just so I can pick up on wireless.
Right. My recommendation, there's two things. Of course, you could always, you know, you could find, there's a Starbucks everywhere. I was in Vancouver this week, and there were two Starbucks on the same intersection in opposing corners. And of course, that's a little bit much. But there's you could always get, a T-Mobile data account and for hotspots and use those Starbucks hotspots if you're going to be in areas like that. I think a better solution for you would be not to use your cell phone data, but to use something similar which is the high-speed data that some carriers offer. Who's your cell phone provider?
I have Verizon and Singular.
Verizon offers a little wireless card, an EVDO, EVDO card, that goes into your laptop and gives you almost broadband access in many areas. Their coverage map is very good. I would check the coverage. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I would check the coverage map, make sure it's going to cover where you're going. When it doesn't, by the way, it doesn't stop working. It just falls back to the slower GPRS that you used last time, which is, as you say, slow, not great, but at least you got something. And in many areas now, this EVDO will work, and it's very fast. $60
okay,
a month,
what about
although
the
if you're
smartphone?
No, it's not the phone, it's the service. So the phone you're using is irrelevant. You could certainly use it. You don't want to bring a laptop with you?
Yeah, I'm going to bring a laptop, but I'm thinking about just, you know, having something in my purse
sure.
if I'm touring somewhere that yeah. I don't have to haul the big laptop.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So use the, absolutely, if it has a smartphone which has a browser. I mean, you're probably not going to want to put up content, but you'll be at least able to check your website, see how they're doing. And if it's on Verizon, when it's using EVDO, the high-speed network, it'll be very snappy. Now, what I would really think about if you're going to do this is maybe getting a smartphone that also supports Wi-Fi. If you do that, then you'll be able to, when you're at a Starbucks or a Wi-Fi hotspot, you'll be able to use high-speed Wi-Fi. When you're not, you may be able to use EVDO. And if you can't use EVDO, you'll at least have GPRS. You'll never be out of touch, and you'll use the fastest speed that's available to you. So that's not a bad way to go. A laptop would do the same
thing. Do you have a recommendation on the smartphone?
I'm trying to remember which ones Verizon offers. I think the Trios do not have Wi-Fi. I'm going to have to look and see which ones, if Verizon offers one with Wi-Fi. I bet you they don't. Verizon's notorious about restricting what you can do with their phones. Singular does. Singular has the 8285. It's very good. That would do use Wi-Fi. More of your calls coming up. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Michelle's question's a great question. I mean, all of us now, especially coming this summer, but in general, travel around a lot and would love to have you. We get spoiled by the high-speed access we have at home. And we'd love to have that everywhere we go. Someday, I'm sure, probably in the next few years, ubiquitous high-speed internet access will be available, no matter where you go. Maybe not in the more rural areas, but if you're near a city center, pretty much anywhere in the world, you should. Okay, that's hyperbole. Anywhere in the most advanced Western world or even Eastern world in Asia and Japan and South Korea, you should be able to get full speed internet access no matter where. I think that's just around the corner. There are technologies like WiMAX, of course, Wi-Fi, high-speed 3G cell networks. This new HSDPA is very fast. That's being rolled out rapidly all over the country. You're going to see a lot of high-speed access. So it's just a matter of time. But even right now, we have much better situation than we have had in years past. There's Wi-Fi access points everywhere. Companies like Sprint and Verizon and Singular rolling out high-speed internet over their cell networks. Not cheap. Unfortunately, not cheap. But, hey, you can do it. If you get one of those laptop cards for Sprint or for Verizon, you've got very nearly broadband access. Interesting article in the Times today about a new kind of mirror you can see in the stores. This is at Bloomingdale's in Manhattan, a prototype for an interactive mirror. It's really a high-resolution digital display. You stand in front of what looks like a mirror, but it's a camera. And then the camera just relays your image to the web. Web viewers send in their comments. You can also select items off the website to try on, and viewers can do this, not just you, and put virtual images of the clothing in front of you. So we were talking last hour about how these virtual worlds have become very addictive and people spend a lot of time in there. Well, now it's even impinging on your real life. You imagine you walk into a department store, you walk up to a mirror, and people all over the internet say, hey, you know, I think you'd look good in this dress. And boom, there's the dress pops up in front of you. I guess the theory is that women like to shop in groups, right? And so if you're alone at Bloomingdale's, you can get some help. What a wild idea. That is just an amazing use of the technology. I don't know what the website is. I neglect to mention this on the Times, but I mean, we're living in that, you know, with between MySpace or Facebook and these social networks, we're really living in a world. I use Twitter all the time, T-W-I-T-T-E-R. And, you know, every once in a while, I'll just type what I'm doing and all my friends see it. And then I see what they're doing. We're living in this virtual community that sometimes you have friends you've never met, but you know more about them than you do about your neighbors. Troy's on the line from Napoleonville, Louisiana. Hello, Troy. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on line four. Hey, Troy.
Leo?
Yes.
What I'm looking to do is make the move to Vista on some existing hardware. I mean, my specs are pretty good. I have a GeForce card, an Intel-based processor, plenty of RAM.
Okay.
But the way I'm doing it is I've installed Vista on a second hard drive in ID chain. And what I do is whenever I want to boot to Vista, I'm physically moving the drive to primary.
Oh, boy.
Now, a few years ago, you used to be able to buy something called a Trios hard drive selector.
Yes.
But I can't find them anymore.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, can I still find them? If not, do you know a better way to accomplish this?
I haven't seen them. That's a good question. I don't know where they went. And, boy, that must be a pain in the butt to move those jumpers around and move those cables around each time you want to boot. Why didn't you just make a dual boot system?
Really didn't kind of want the headache, really. I mean,
It's not too late. I think you could actually even do it now. Remember that XP and Vista no longer have to be on the C drive.
Right.
So you could have XP on what used to be the primary drive, Vista on what used to be the secondary drive, but either can boot, depending on your bootloader. So when you installed Vista, you installed it on another machine and then moved the drive over?
Well, no, I mean, it's both hard drives are just swapping back on the same machine.
Yeah.
So I have Vista on
So I see. So you unplugged the XP drive when you installed Vista.
That is correct.
Yeah. Had you left it in, Vista would say, hey, I see you have XP. I'll install myself on the second drive, and what I'll do is I'll put a bootloader on the XP drive, and when you boot up, I'll give you the choice.
Yeah, I may have to give that a shot.
That's the way to do it. Now, after the fact, let's think about this. I don't know. Because what happens is it has to put a bootloader. XP needs to have the bootloader on its partition. Vista doesn't care. So they're going to use XP because XP is the most demanding. They're going to do what XP wants. So it means that the NT loader will live on XP's partition. And now that means that after the fact, it's kind of hard for you to do that. I think what would probably work is to connect them both, reinstall Vista on top of itself. And it probably will very easily and quickly do it. It probably will say, oh, I see you have all the files. The only thing I need to do is do this bootloader.
Okay.
Give that a try. I bet you that'll work. That'll be a lot easier than switching back and forth. The only reason you'd want to do what you're doing is if you just didn't want it to see the other drive.
Well, this is really not ready for prime time.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
My software is concerned.
Well, and that's why they support it in the Vista install so well, because they know, and business is the same thing. Business isn't going to just say, okay, fine, we're throwing out XP, we're going to start new Vista. They want to have that dual boot capability as well. Hey, coming up in just a bit, our gadget guru, Ron Rosberg, with a hot new gadget. I don't know when it'll be. Let's find out. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Laporte, jamming with you. Yaman. I am the tech guy for the Tech Guy Labs, Northern California, talking about all of this cool stuff that's happening out there. Everything from PDAs to cell phones to home theater. Ron Rosberg is my gadget guru, and he joins us every week with a fun gadget. Was at the PMA show a couple of weeks ago, gave us an update on that last week. Hey, Ron, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm pretty good this week.
Recovered? Did your plane get fixed?
Not yet. Not yet. Leo, can we put up a donation site?
That's all the rage now, you know. If you want money, they just internet begging.
I need a donation. People different quarters and they haven't even taken the thing off to tell me what the damage is going to be yet. I'm scared. But I remember a friend of mine got ran over a ladder. We'll have to talk about that later.
Yeah, yeah, that wasn't so bad. I just had to replace my bumper. That's all.
Is that it?
Yeah, you know, I was driving down. Actually, it looked like a neat event that Sprint was putting on to show off these cards that we've been talking about, these
right, the EBTO, that's yeah.
And I was on my way down, and somebody left a stepladder in the roadway, in the highway, and I hit it at 55 miles an hour, I swear, and took out the whole bumper there. So I limped back home. Everything seems to be all right now, though. I got it all fixed.
Yeah, unlike the people we were going to see want you to give a police report so they could verify that, please.
I never reported it to the police, but I can give them my insurance papers. I can show them the check I wrote.
Right, right.
So, gadget guru.
Hey, anyway, before I start, I got two items I want to talk about today, but I want to tell you about that lady who called. Leo, you're looking for a phone, and you know I always carry a few phones with me. But you talked, I think yesterday, you talked about the 6700 also.
That's from Sprint.
HTC, but it's available on both Verizon and Sprint, which is an ideal phone because it is EBDO.
And Wi-Fi.
And Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
Yep.
You know, and between the two, between Sprint and Verizon, what I do like about the Sprint, Leo, is that they don't turn, when you use the Verizon, you either use the phone or Wi-Fi. You can't use both. And there are times that you could be on, want to use Wi-Fi while you're on the phone. Okay.
I hate that. I have a phone that I can't look at the calendar when I'm talking. And
exactly.
That's
so
just
here,
frustrating.
Here with the Sprint, it's kind of the one I would choose on the two. But that would be a perfect solution. It's got a 1.2 megapixel camera on it, and it has EBDO.
The issue with Sprint is coverage map. It's not as extensive as Verizon's.
No, I tell you, take a look at both. Like you suggest, go on and look at the maps. I think they both have really good coverage. They both are probably, I think, one of the best coverages around.
One of the advantages of Sprint is if you do fall back to Sprint PCS, it's actually faster than GPRS.
But you can get, I think it's like $10 a month or unlimited. Or $15
a
month.
That's a big difference because Verizon's 60 bucks.
You want to look at the, I think it's called Vision or whatever.
All right.
And by the way, your speeds, I think on regular EBDO, you're probably looking at about, they claim between 400 and 1.5 on download, and about 100 to 150 probably on upload. Now, by the way, I'll be talking about this later, but if you're looking at that Rev A card, by the way, which is phenomenal, that, Leo, speeds, I'm getting speeds of 700 upload.
And I tell you,
double my Comcast and 1300 download.
The only caveat I'd have about that is because it's a brand new card, you're not competing with a lot of people yet.
Well, that's true.
And what you find with all of these cell systems is, it has to do with how many people are using that particular cell site.
And Leo, I found out another thing, too. When I was in Vegas playing around with these cards, I happened to be in a building on the 18th floor.
Yeah.
And I got speeds, I have to tell you this, of like 20 and 20 and 32 and 32.
Wow.
Half a dialed up because I was either up too high and overshot it or I was behind a building. So that's something you got to look at. One of the guys says, I got to move immediately down to the fourth floor.
No, I think that's true. In fact, I've canceled cell service contracts because it wouldn't work in my office building. It's not at all unusual.
Yeah. So
anyway, we don't have unlimited time, Ron, and we're eating it up. So let's get to your gadgets.
Leo, last week your TV guy was taught, you guys kind of mentioned about cables. And I thought one of the items I want to talk to you, I've mentioned this to you before. One of my listeners on my other show had told me about this company. It's called monoprice.com, Leo.
Mm-hmm.
And HDMI cables. I'm going to give you an example. Like a 3-foot HDMI cable, like about $4.
Oh, okay. My goodness.
You can get 25-foot cables. Just unbelievable pricing on this stuff. It's probably about 10% of what you'd pay in the store. And they have lifetime warranties on the cables. I've been using them now for about 4 or 5 months, and I'm really happy with them. You can get either a 28 gauge or a 24 gauge.
Look at this, a 6-foot HDMI cable for $5.25. That's amazing.
Yeah, Leo, and as I say, excellent, excellent cables. I have some very expensive cables at my home also, and I'll tell you, between the two, you really can't tell the difference. They stand behind this stuff. You can get next day shipping if you want.
Monoprice.com.
And by the way, switches. You know, if you right now, a lot of the TVs, as you know, only have one HDMI hookup. Now, there was a company I talked about months ago on another station that their switches, Leo, for like a 3-switch for HDMI, if you want to put in your DVD player and some other stuff that's coming out with HDMI, you had to spend $300 to $400 for switches.
Yeah.
Their switches, listen to this here, you can get a two switch, so you could have two hookups on it, $28.
That's great.
If you want three, it's $67, so the prices are about, you know, 25% of what you would pay if you had to go buy this other company. So take a look. If you're looking for some cables, I cannot recommend this company any higher. Monoprice.com, just a great little company.
I'm making a note. I'm going to keep, because I just got this new Xacti HD2, and it's for the first time ever, it's got HDMI on it.
Right, and, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And
I only have one HDMI input, of course, on my
exactly.
Fancy TV.
The other item I want to talk about, Leo, is when we were talking about cell phones a moment ago, I've been playing around with a product called Jawbone. It's a Bluetooth headset. And I mean, it's very small. It's probably about an inch and a half. Very attractive cosmetically. They've done a great job on it. And I played with their first one, which had a bunch of wires on it that I saw at demo about 2 years ago. And finally, they came out with a Bluetooth version, which there's no wires at all. I can get about 9 hours of use. And I am, you know, I use
you
my
talk
cell
a lot.
Yeah, I know. I do.
Saying something.
I know. I use my cell phone all the time. I don't. My landline diverts to my cell phone.
Right.
So I'm looking for ones that are 8, 9 hours. 3 hours just doesn't do it for me, okay? I would have to carry two or three. But what was unique about this is that they've actually got started with the military of coming out with a canceling thing for the military to be able to hear real well, like in battle zones and stuff like that. So they have taken this technology now and put it into their Jawbone.
We should do a demo. You should call me from like a noisy place,
yeah,
on this
but
thing.
Leo, they on their site, jawbone.com, you'll find they'll have one with a train station. They have 5 or 6 different applications that you could play
is
with.
Is this the one that you had me play with at the ball game last year?
No. That was a headset. That would actually went
was
over
that
your
the
ear.
Boom? Or?
Yeah, that's the boom.
And is this as good as the boom? Better than the
boom? This one here is just a very small weight, you know, very lightweight. I could keep it on my ear almost. I'll wear it like 10, 12 hours a day. And it identifies and isolates your speech. It's the only headset that has proprietary voice activity sensor. So you have a button, you could press it on or off. But if you were out with a leaf, for example, the other day I was washing my car, and the gardeners were here with their leaf blowers. And it would drive me crazy. But the people on the other side could not even hear the leaf blower. That's how good it is. If you're in your car with your radio turned up or whatever, you don't have to turn your radio down unless you can't hear or whatever. But it's a Jawbone. It's available only at singular stores. And it sells for $119.95.
Does
it's also going to
does
be
it only work with singular phones?
No. It works with any Bluetooth phone. Leo, works with any Bluetooth phone.
I'm going to compare this to my $50 Plantronics traveler.
Well, you'll find out your $50 Plantronics has like a 3 or 4 hour life on it. And
that's true.
This is for people who need to be able to put it on like I do in the morning and take it off at night. And that's basically, it's got tremendous battery power on it. And if you want... I have tested. I'm going to be testing another Plantronics with DSP in it, but this thing here for loud noise is absolutely fantastic. The write-ups go on to their website. You'll see all the other companies who wrote it up. But it's called the Jawbone, available at singular. The price is $119.95, and it will be available on Jawbone.com in different colors.
Looks like a little red Band-Aid on your cheek.
No, it actually is very good looking. I have had more compliments on this piece. It's cosmetically designed.
Anything that makes Ron look good has got to be good.
The only is having two, one on each side, though, Leo. I need one on both sides of my ear. So,
well, that's why I like my Plantronics, because it will bond to two different phones.
No, I'm only using one phone at a time.
Really?
Yeah, well, one at a time, Leo.
At a time. Oh, all right. But you carry how many?
I carry about 6.
All right. Ron Rosberg, we just wanted to establish that fact. Ron Rosberg is the gadget guru, joins us every week at this hour to talk about his favorite gadgets. A couple of good ones. One, a great place to get cables, monoprice.com, and then the Jawbone at jawbone.com and singular stores. Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome, and I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Leo Laporte, the tech Guy. Let's see if we can squeeze a call in here before we run off to a break. Harry in Lancaster, California, line two. Harry, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, Leo, I've got an HP P4 2.3 gig machine. Got 768 mega RAM. And I keep getting pop-ups on my screen saying I've run low on virtual memory.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you do about it? So I went in, I keep increasing. I'm up to, you know, 400 meg of virtual memory.
Oh, no, you need to
now.
Have, you would want at least 150% of your existing RAM. So you should set your virtual memory to, I would suggest 2 gigs.
Okay. Put virtual up to 2?
Yeah, you really are low.
Okay, I can bump my the machine up to 1 gig of actual RAM. Would that help?
Well, here's the thing: virtual memory is hard drive space that's used when you run out of RAM. It's obviously not something you want to do because your hard drive is much slower than memory. With XP and 768 of RAM, you're probably not going to run out a lot unless you start running a lot of programs simultaneously. When that happens, instead of crashing or saying "I'm sorry, I can't do anymore," the machine starts using the hard drive as memory. 400 megs, not nearly enough to do that. And you should always have some swap space on Windows. Always. My recommendation, at least 1.5 times the amount of memory. So in that case, at least a gig. But, you know, hard drive space is plentiful and cheap. Frankly, nowadays with XP and certainly with Vista, I would let Windows manage the swap file, or as they call it, the page file. So instead of... We used to say, oh, to make things faster, establish a fixed size swap file and make it 1.5 times the amount of RAM you have. I would just turn off all of that and just, you know, when you go into the virtual memory, you right click My Computer, you go to Properties, and you're going to go to Advanced, and you're going to go to the Performance Settings. And then under the Advanced tab of the Performance Settings, boy, they hide it under Virtual Memory, you press Change and just click System Managed Size and press Set. Let Windows do it. It'll pick an appropriate size. It'll grow it and shrink it appropriately. And with modern versions of Windows like XP and Vista, you just don't have the same problems you used to have. More of your calls coming up. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ask Leo is my number, 888-827-5536. Love to talk tech with you, as we do every week at this time. Show notes are online at techguylabs.com. My email is leo@techguylabs.com. And the chat room is irc.dslextreme.com. Or just go to techguylabs.com, and there's a link to the chat room on that site and explains everything you need to know about joining us in our chat. Always fun to participate in the chat. Let's move on to our next call. Jody's on the line, on line 5 from Lafayette, Tennessee. Hello, Jody.
Hello, Leo.
How are you today?
I've got a couple of things for you, but one of them, first I want to tell you, I'm blind.
Okay.
And I have one game that I depend totally on speech and sounds.
Okay.
So I've got this one game, this guy wrote it, I don't know why, but it's wonderful.
Oh,
called Golf, Win Golf. And you can sit there and you can play this thing for hours. It goes by now, sound effect.
How do you play it? Is it specifically for blind people, or is it just...
It is. Specifically for blind people. You don't see much screen graphic in it.
How excellent. What a great idea.
It's fantastic. I mean, your speech tells you where you are. Are you there?
Yeah, somebody's calling you to say that you're on the radio right now, Jody.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Jody, you're on the radio. I know I am. Thank you. Are there a lot of games designed for blind people where they don't bother with the graphics? It's just all audio?
Most of it's all audio, yeah.
What a great idea.
We do have a website out there called All in Play.
AllInPlay.com?
Yeah.
I'm gonna put this in the show notes. What a great idea.
Yeah, you're going to love this one. It's for blind or sighted people. And we get together, we play Crazy Eights, five-card draw, or Texas Hold'em.
What fun.
And we have tournaments. And
it's $8, around $8 a month.
That's about it, yeah.
And so if you're sighted, there'll be stuff on the screen. But if
stuff
you're
on the screen, but if you're blind, there's speech, and you can set different speech systems like JAWS, which I use,
mm-hmm.
or Window Eyes, like other people use.
Yep. Need to use a screen reader, or will it do it without a screen reader?
It won't do it without a screen reader if you're blind.
So it sends the commands to JAWS, and JAWS interprets them.
Yes, and JAWS interprets it.
Got it. That makes sense because different people...
all kinds of wonderful sound effects.
How fun.
I mean, when you lose it, it goes a raspberry kind of thing. or when you win the hand, it claps.
Yay!
And when you enter a site, you hear a little thing goes bling.
What a great idea.
These sighted guys set it up. And they did it because they realized there was one thing that their blind friends couldn't be one-on-one with them that they could fix. So they fixed it.
I think this is an example, a very good example of how technology can be such a boon for differently abled people, because the computer, you know, can work in whatever realm you want to work in. It's very good at that. It doesn't care. I mean, the computer is blind too, isn't it, after all? So it can, if it's sound that you need, it'll give you sound. If it's touch, I've seen Braille devices that are remarkable that will actually on the fly read to you through Braille. Have you seen those devices where they actually forms the Braille under your fingertips?
I've used them.
Yeah, isn't that a great technology?
I mean, there are these little refreshable units, and these little dots are popping out.
Yeah.
And you're going along, because I'm a fast reader, and I'll be going along with one hand clicking cursor keys.
Isn't that a clever application? I just think that's fantastic.
It is.
I just love that. Well, Jody, I thank you for calling and filling us in. And I know we have a number of blind listeners. It's one of the things about radio that's great is, of course, it doesn't matter if you're sighted or not. It's allinplay.com. Allinplay.com if you want to participate. They've got poker, Texas Hold'em. They've got draw poker, and they've got crazy eights. And I think that's a neat idea. Thank you for listening, Jody. We appreciate it. Eric on line 3, Bakersfield. Eric, I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo?
Well, Eric, how are you?
I'm great. I had a question about websites and the security on them. I've got a website, and I've made a subdirectory where I put my medical information, release forms and stuff like that, medical cards.
Yes, you want to secure that for sure.
Well, my question is, since it's not linked to from any page...
Doesn't matter.
How easy is it going to be for somebody to spot it?
Well, this is what we call security by obscurity. In other words, you're not doing anything to protect it. You're just not telling anybody where it is. Now, the problem is search engines sometimes spider through the directories. They might find it by accident. Or somebody who's kind of determined to find it might find it just by trying things. I mean, what you have is called an open directory. There's no HTML page in there. There's no index.html. But because if somebody goes to that directory, they'll see the files there. You want to close it up. The first thing you should do is put an empty index.html file in there, just a blank file that's named index.html. What that'll do is if a browser does get to that page, they'll get a blank page. If you want to get a little more sophisticated, instead of having a empty index.html, you could have a little script in there that points it to a website. So they go to the page, maybe by accident, maybe intentionally, and what they'll get is some other page.
Well, the problem is that we want to use this instead of Medic Alert. We've got
you want people to be able to go there. I see. All right, here's what you do. You need to password protect it.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah. Well, otherwise a spider will find it. If it's there, it's sitting out there. I mean, it depends on how important it is to you that nobody see this. I would submit very. But it's up to you, of course. It's your information.
Right. How likely is it somebody's going to do that? I mean,
is there a regular website in the same location?
Right.
Okay. But there's no, and what you're saying as well, since nothing links on that website to that page, it's not going to find it. But sometimes browsers, yeah, I would. If, there's two things you want to do, and you're going to check your webmaster on this. One is robots.txt, and one is htaccess, and I would protect it. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number. 8888 ASKLEO or 888-827-5536. If you want to talk about tech, anything you want to talk about, whether it's home theater, cell phones, camcorders, PDAs, internet, computers, Linux, Mac, Windows, Vista, XP. I better stop because I can just go on and on. 8888 Ask Leo. Coming up, we're going to answer the eternal question. Very excited about this. LCD or plasma? Scott Wilkinson's here from the Ultimate AV Guide, and he'll join us about half an hour to at least break down the differences so you can decide if you're in the market for an HDTV. I solved it by buying one of each. A smaller LCD for the living room, where it's, you know, brighter daylight conditions, and for the home theater, you know, the darkened room, I got a bigger plasma. But it's not an easy decision, and of course, if these are expensive enough, you probably don't want to buy one of each. We can talk about it, answer your questions too. 8888 Ask Leo. I cannot stop playing with Twitter, and now it's even more addictive. Do you know what Twitter is? I know this is the kind of thing where it's hard to describe, hard to explain, and then if you start using it, you might kind of get hooked on it. I was talking earlier in the show about community and how now we can create our community virtually. Not, you know, it used to be your community was your tribe, your village. Then when we got to cities and towns, it was your neighbors or maybe perhaps the people in your profession that you, you know, at work or in your guild. But now your community can be global. It's often composed of people you've never met. People who merely share your interests. Look at places like MySpace and Facebook, where people have thousands of friends, most of whom they've never met. And you might say, well, they aren't really community. They aren't really friends. And that might be true in many cases. They're just acquaintances, if even that. But sometimes they are quite close. You can, via chat and email and phone calls, get to know somebody very well. People have even married other people that they've only met online, and then obviously they have to meet in person at some point, but the relationship often begins online. Twitter is a community service of that kind. It's brand new. It's from the folks, it's actually from Evan Williams, a guy who wrote Blogger, sold it to Google a few years ago and took that money and invested it in a new company called Obvious. And the first thing Obvious did was kind of a flop, I'm sorry to say. It was Odeo. It was a service to make it easy to create and subscribe to podcasts, and it just didn't take off, mostly because Apple entered the market with iTunes right about the same time, and that was it on that. Timing's a lot, almost everything when it comes to launching a new web business. It's bad timing in this case. Good idea, bad timing, and good execution. Odeo was great. And then as a little side line, Obvious developed something called Twitter. Twitter is, how do I describe it? It's kind of like instant messaging. It's a service. You go to twitter.com, you can sign up. It's absolutely free. And all you really do is you can do it on the website. You can do it through a chat client or through your cell phone text messaging. Is you just every once in a while, you answer the question, what are you doing right now? You can say other things too. Often people will make jokes or but it's not about talking with one another. It's merely saying, here's what I'm doing right now. And once you join, you can follow people. You can pick people and say, hey, I want to know what you're doing right now. I want to know what you're doing right now. And you'll have a small group, maybe of almost like your community of friends that you care about what they're up to. And then you may And what you'll do is you'll get updates. You'll either get them on your chat client, you can get them on the web page, or you can get them on your cell phone even, or your BlackBerry, of what your friends are up to right now. And it's strangely compelling. You would think, this is silly. So who cares? You had waffles for breakfast. Hey, whoopee, uh-huh. It's kind of like instant blogging, you know, and you're limited because they want to make it work with text messaging. You only can type 140 characters. There's no graphics. You could put web links in there, but that's about it. And yet it's strangely compelling. And now there's a new service that makes it addictive. It's Twitter Map. So I've been using Twitter for a while. My Twitter name is Leo Laporte. If you want to see what I post, you just go to twitter.com/Leo Laporte and you'll see my postings. You could join and you could follow me if you wanted. There's several thousand people who are following me around. Some people call it stalker cam, stalker vision. Not that I say anything interesting, I don't. But yeah, I guess you can follow along somebody's day-to-day activities. It's more fun with friends, let's face it. There's some celebrities on there. John Edwards, the presidential candidate, is on there. I think all the presidential candidates are going to be looking at new ways to use the web, as John Dean did last campaign, to build awareness and contributors and so forth. So John Edwards is trying Twitter. He's the only candidate I know of that's on Twitter right now. But this Twitter map is kind of neat. They have a thing called Twitter Vision, which is a lot. Now, this is where you'll kind of understand a little bit better what Twitter's up to. They have a live updating map of the world. I don't think these are all the tweets. That's what they call these little Twitter messages. I think they randomly pick and choose a tweet a second or so. But you see a pin in the map where the person is Twittering from and then what they're saying. And so, for instance, I'm gonna right now in Twitter, I'm going to type talking about Twitter Vision on the radio. So there'll be a pin in the map at my location at the Leoville Labs, and it'll say what I just said, talking about Twitter Vision on the radio. And then but what happens is you're watching this, and you're seeing people all over the world saying things in all kinds of languages, and it's very interesting, strangely compelling. I bring it up just because it's you never know exactly what the next big thing is going to be on the net, and it's sometimes not obvious. It's sometimes not, a little pun there, since the company that makes this is called Obvious. It's sometimes non-obvious what is going to be the next big thing, and you wouldn't think to look at it that Twitter would be, but in some weird ways, it's very compelling. 8888 Ask Leo. I was talking at the beginning of the show about what was it, the line racing? I mean, that is something else you wouldn't think is very compelling, and yet somehow it just grabs you. That's the weird thing about the net. Let's go to line 5. Tom is on the line in Seal Beach. Hello, Tom. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Listen, I've been using iPhantom. I wonder if it needs to be updated or if there's a better thing to use on my internet cable.
Is it not doing what you want?
Pardon?
Is it not doing what you want? Or
I don't know. I'm still getting some junk, some spyware down.
Ooh, all right. Well, first of all, nothing's perfect.
Okay.
But yes, you can update it, and you should update it regularly. iPhantom is a hardware device. It's not exactly a firewall. It's more like the kind of devices that big businesses use. Like these big Barracudas or Astaro devices that are boxes they put on their network that do all the filtering and the antivirus and all that. In effect, you're doing that not in that little iPhantom device. That little iPhantom device is forwarding all your internet traffic through the iPhantom servers where they do that kind of heavy-duty filtering. So they automatically update the antivirus, automatically update the anti-spyware. All of that stuff is handled, but sometimes you want to update the firmware on the device just to speed it up or to add features, and that you can do in the device setup.
Okay.
But I have to tell you, and I want to really say this, it's about all security devices or software or hardware. Nothing's perfect. Ultimately, your behavior is the first line of defense. These things just back you up. But if you're going to sites where spyware is, you know, they offer to download spyware, you know, sometimes these things can't protect you. You've got to be careful about what you say yes to online. You can't open attachments, even though you've got, you know, your email being filtered for viruses. You know, viruses come out quickly, and sometimes it takes a while for the updates to go out. And so there's always a little window of vulnerability.
I unplugged my internet cable. Is there a switch I can put in?
There is. There are a number of companies that make these. That's not, I'll be honest with you. If you have like the iPhantom, or if you have a router.
Yes, I have a router and iPhantom.
You don't have to worry about turning off your internet. That's protecting you against passive infection. Really, what you have to do is protect against yourself. Or who, remember the caller earlier in the show with his nephew got the computer for 5 minutes and he got spyware on it. It's how you behave. So it's really not. People say, "Oh, I don't. You know, when I'm not there, I don't want anything bad to happen." It's not when you're not there that bad things happen. It's when you're there. It's stuff you're doing.
It's when I boot up the first few minutes. It all of my programs. It seems like everybody in my computer. That's all my programs. They all went to go
right
to the internet, and it slows down my boot process.
That's right.
They all go to the internet before my anti-spyware or anything can.
That's not
up.
True. You're protected, but they're not going to bring down anything bad. It's not that's again. It's not those programs. It's you surfing the net. It's you opening email attachments. It's the things that you do. So we have on the website, and I'll put a link to it on the show notes. That my 5 rules for safe computing, and it's really all about changing your behavior. It's having a firewall. You got that. It's not downloading files from unknown sites, particularly music sites. That's what his nephew did, I'm sure. He downloaded some music, or what he thought was music turned out to be spyware. It's making sure you run Windows Update regularly and you apply those updates so that any holes in your system are automatically patched. It's not opening email attachments because that's how viruses get in. And it's saying no to websites when they ask you, can we install something? No. Those things will protect you. The software and the hardware, that's the second line of defense in case you slip up. So if you do those things, I truly think you're safe. And I'll tell you, if you're running OS X or you're running Vista, those operating systems will back you up. The real risk right now is running an older version of Windows. XP is problematic. 95, 98, and ME are nightmares. That's where you get in trouble. It is one strong reason to go to Vista, frankly, is it's much more secure. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up. 88-88. Ask Leo. Port, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my phone number. 8888 Ask Leo. Back to the phones we go. Line 4, Mike, San Diego. Welcome, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Hey.
You make geek being cool, man. I got to tell you that to start off with.
Hey, I make old being cool, too. It's pretty amazing, huh? Old geek, even worse.
I know.
How do I do it?
Well, What I was calling for is I got this phone that has Bluetooth on it, right?
Okay.
And I have this huge car stereo in my truck, but the funny thing is that I end up turning down all the bass and everything like that so I can listen to AM radio. But my problem is that when I want to listen to like a punk rock CD or something like that, I have to turn my phone on vibrate and put it underneath my
right, because you won't hear
so
it.
I can get phone calls.
Right.
So I know that new cars have this Bluetooth feature in it that hooks up to the stereo. So
yep.
When your phone rings, it basically turns your car into a speakerphone.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, the Prius does that. A number of cars do that now. Yeah.
Yeah. What I was wondering is if there's an aftermarket car stereo that has that feature that I can install into my truck so I don't have to have that problem.
That's a great question. I don't know of one, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to hear there is such a thing. I'll tell you let's ask our audience. I bet you there's a stereo installer who's listening right now who says, we do it. So
Glenwood X25 whatever.
Yeah, right? And I'll let them do that. I don't mind that kind of a plug. I would be very interested. It shouldn't be a difficult thing to do. You just need a head end that speaks Bluetooth.
Right, exactly. So I wasn't sure if you had.
I haven't heard of one.
Know of a brand that
no.
works, or if
you know who's you know who's the most advanced in terms of technology is Alpine, and
okay.
If anybody did it, I would bet you Alpine would do it, but I just don't know. I haven't seen anything like that, and I haven't heard about anything like that. Let's see here. Bluetooth interface adapter.
And hopefully someone will call in for me, and I'll check the show notes.
All right, great,
also.
Mike. Yeah, and I'm just looking. I do see that Crutchfield sells a Bluetooth adapter for Alpine stereo. Works with.
In fact, I have an Alpine in my truck.
There you go. So you may not even need to get a new.
It'll be compatible.
You might not need to get a new head end. It's a $200. It's a one-time process. Prepares the phone for use. That would be the bonding. The KCA100BT. Once the system has been set up, the Bluetooth connection initializes automatically as soon as you get in the car. Doesn't say if it mutes the stereo, but I would think since it's going right into the Alpine, it must.
Sure.
So I would take a look at that.
Well, I appeal to your listeners.
And if they know, if they've tried
somebody
it,
somebody call in with some experience.
Somebody will. Somebody will, Mike. Hey, thank you. I appreciate the call.
Thanks so much, Leo.
Take care. Bye. Yeah, Alpine makes this, so I'm thinking it's going to work well with the Alpine system. But and usually Crutchfield has some pretty good reviews. I'm just seeing, yeah, with the interface, you can initiate, answer, and end a call on your Bluetooth telephone without touching it. You can speak to them through the supplied microphone and listen to their voice through the vehicle's speakers. During the call, the head end mutes the current source being played so you can hear the call. Your punk music goes down. The call goes up. Sounds great. In fact, if your phone supports voice tags, it'll even dial. So you can say, call Leo, and it'll dial 8888 Ask Leo. Now, that's cool. Anybody have experience with this or another Bluetooth add-on, aftermarket add-on for your car stereo? Let us know. 8888 Ask Leo. Line 2, Mick the Wick from Senecaville, Ohio. Hello, Mick.
Well, hello, Leo. Thank you for taking my call, buddy.
You know why we call him Mick the Wick, folks? Because he makes candles. Right?
Yeah, yeah. You have a good memory, Leo.
Of course I remember that. How would I forget that?
Your memory is a little unfortunate on my behalf, because yesterday Dick was talking to you about getting your PS3 for your birthday, hoping you forget before November.
Yeah, see, I remember everything.
Yeah, then I come on the chat and told you I was going to give you a 450 Mercedes SEL for your birthday.
I'm looking forward to that nice.
Hope you forget.
I'm looking forward to that nice car you're going to buy me, Mick. Thank you very
I
much.
I lost sleep last night, buddy. I figured I'm going to wind up paying $80,000 for a.
No, don't
Mercedes
be silly. I wouldn't let you do it.
I'm going to stand behind my word.
Send me a candle, a Mercedes-shaped candle. Then you, you'll be off the hook.
If I get a 450 SEL for my birthday, I'm giving it to you.
That you're a good man. What can I do for you, Mick?
Leo, the chat room, I'd like to say thanks to Mike and Dan, Dustin and Illuminati, for keeping it clean. It's a very friendly, family-friendly chat. They do a great job, and we just have a great time.
I second that emotion. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, very good. Hey, my game that I like on the internet is called Save Harold. It's a little quick hangman game.
All right, I'm going to try this here. Save Harold, huh? Okay.
Yeah, it's called Save Harold. You can Google for it. It comes from pyzam.com, pyzam.com. And it's just a little quick hangman game, and it's a great lot of fun.
Well, thank you for that tip. You know, it's amazing. These little free flash games are so much fun. You say, Harold, you remind me that, you know, I was talking about that line game, the line racing game. And I think or line rider, I guess it's called. One of the reasons my son likes is when he was a kid, we read to him a book called Harold and the Purple Crayon, in which Harold takes a purple crayon and draws these lines through the entire book. And I'm thinking maybe that's why Henry likes Line Rider. And then Harold reminds me of it.
Yeah,
hey, Mick, it's great to hear from you. Say hi to all the folks in the chat room. You can join Mick in the IRC chat. It's available through the web, irc.dslextreme.com. And that's a website, but you'll see there's a little Java client on there. You can chat, or if you're IRC savvy and you have an IRC client like Merck or XChat, we give you instructions how to get into the chat room there. And as Mick said, great bunch of people in there, and it's well moderated, so it's a safe place to be. Coming up in just a bit, LCD or plasma? What's your next HDTV? Scott Wilkinson will divide the line in just a bit. Stay right here.
Exactly where I stand. If one is forced to leave.
Scott Wilkinson. He's video editor at the Perfect Vision magazine at avguide.com. And today Scott's going to talk to us about kind of the eternal question. LCD versus plasma.
It's the number one question that people ask.
Yeah. Well, they're both flat screen.
Yep.
They both can hang on your wall.
Mm-hmm.
Which is better?
The answer is, it depends.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. Each of them have their pros and their cons. Plasma, the pros for plasma are generally better blacks, lower black level, deeper blacks when you're watching a space movie like Star Wars or something. The black looks deeper, inkier, more velvety. Generally, and I'm only talking in general terms here. There are exceptions to everything, but generally speaking, plasma has a wider viewing angle. You can be off-center, off-axis, and still enjoy a reasonably good-looking picture. And they're generally less expensive than LCD in large screen sizes.
Once you get past, say, 50 inches.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. LCDs need to be made in clean room environment, which plasma does not. So that's one reason. Although the price gap between them is closing fast as the prices for both are falling in free fall, essentially.
Right, right.
The cons for plasma, there's this thing called burn-in, which is much less of a problem today than it was in early versions of plasma, but it still can be a problem if you like watching 4x3 material, regular old normal TV, on a 16x9 screen. After a while, after a few days of watching that, when you first turn the TV on, you see this sort of 4x3 window burned into the 16x9 screen. Now, if you watch some 16x9 material, that'll generally go away. Plasmas also offer what are called like screen wipe functions, which flood the whole screen with white and try to eliminate this burn-in. But if you keep the TV on for days or weeks at a time, say, for example, on a news channel with a ticker along the bottom,
right.
That's going to get burned in eventually.
People
You'll see that
get mad at us on Tech TV because we never moved our bug. And
right.
People would watch Tech TV like 24 hours a day, and after a few weeks of that, you'd have a Tech TV bug on your TV no matter what you were watching.
That's exactly right. And plasmas are less susceptible to them than they used to be, but still it's a little bit of a problem.
My son is so paranoid because I drill it into him. You will turn off that video game when you are done. You will not leave the TV. And so not only does he turn it off, he powers it all the way down. He practically unplugs the darn thing because he is terrified that dad's going to mess with my plasma.
Video games are another big problem with plasma in this regard. Yeah. Also, plasmas are generally lower resolution than comparably sized LCDs. LCDs can achieve a higher resolution for a given screen size than plasma, although both are now... We're starting to see plasmas at 1920 across by 1080 down. LCDs have been there for longer, and they can be at that high resolution at smaller screen sizes than plasmas. So that brings me to the LCDs. And then one of the advantages of LCDs is that they are generally higher in resolution than comparable plasmas. Also, they really don't suffer from burn-in. There is some controversy over whether or not LCDs do have their own form of burn-in, but it's even if it's there, it's much less of a problem than plasma, so it's really not that big a deal.
Somebody once told me that LCD is better in a brighter room and plasma is better in a darker room.
Correct. My next point was that LCDs are very high brightness. And so if you're watching TV in a room with ambient light, say in a family room or a multi-purpose room or something like that, LCD is generally a very good choice there because they're so high brightness. They have a backlight that shines through a panel of LCD crystals, pixels, and the pixels either block or let light through. And so they generally have a higher brightness than plasmas, although plasmas are no slouches when it comes to brightness either. Disadvantages of LCD include a relatively narrow viewing angle. So if you go off axis, if you go off center from the screen, the black level starts to come up, the contrast starts to go down, the colors start to shift. It starts looking pretty funky. Now, modern, contemporary, current versions of LCDs are getting better at this. They're learning how to do this better. And the last couple of LCDs I've looked at actually do a surprisingly good job at it, but it's still not as good as plasma. The other big problem with LCDs in my book are washed out blacks. The black level just isn't as deep as it is with plasma because of that backlight again, because you're always pushing light through the LCD panel, which cannot 100% block it. So a little bit washed out blacks. Another problem that is not as much of a problem these days as it used to be is what's called motion lag, which is the LCD pixels take a little while, a few milliseconds, to switch state, to go from one state to another. And this can sometimes, if it's slow enough, cause moving objects on the screen to look like they have little ghostly tails following them.
Right.
Again, this is not as much of a problem as it used to be. And if you get an LCD panel with a spec that's called response time, and if that's under 8 milliseconds, you're fine. Not a problem.
So really, the differences between LCD and plasma have narrowed considerably. Price,
response
time, black levels.
Yep. They have narrowed over time, and it's less of a problem. Each of the cons that I've spoke of are less of a problem now than they used to be, and the pros are still pros. Yeah. So, but if you're gonna, again, if you're going to be in an ambient light situation, LCD is generally preferred.
I have a Sharp Aquos in my living room.
And Sharp is among the best LCDs made.
And a Pioneer Plasma, because I listen to your reviews, I have Pioneer Plasma in the home theater, and it looks great, but we darken the room, and it's just great.
That's exactly the way I would suggest it. If you're a movie guy and you really want to watch movies and you want to appreciate the picture quality in a dark room, I would probably say plasma. Yeah. If you're in a family room situation, I would say LCD.
We don't even have the cable hooked up to the Pioneer. It's just for watching movies. So.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's always good to talk to you. You've made me feel much better, Scott. And I hope you've made our audience feel better, too. You can see more of read more of Scott's work online at avguide.com. He's video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine. You can get yourself a free copy. Every month, they actually put out the magazine not only on the newsstands in print, but a PDF version that you can download. Full quality. In some ways, it's better than the newsstand version because it's got links to video, to specs, more details about the things you're reading. Really is.
In particular, more technical information in the video reviews than what are available in the print edition.
All those numbers that you do, you generate in your lab show up online because they're not going to spend all that, put all that ink and paper out for all of those.
It is.
I'm so glad you guys do this. I mean, it's a wonderful magazine. I've always liked it. And now to be able to download it is fantastic. AVGuide.com. And Scott joins us every week. So we'll talk again next week about home theater. Thanks, Scott.
You bet.
To follow up a little bit on some of the topics we've been talking about on the show today, I got a bunch of emails. So let me just do a couple of these before we get back to the calls. By the way, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Shuby gave me a link to a hands-free device from Motorola, the IHF-1000 Bluetooth car kit, another aftermarket upgrade. Not sure if this would mute the stereo, though, but what's nice, they do show what phones it works with. And this site, behandsfree.com, has links to other Bluetooth car kits. Ron Rosberg, who's still listening, also pointed out that Parrot makes a head unit, stereo head unit with Bluetooth. It's called the Parrot Rhythm and Blue. It's a CD, MP3, Bluetooth car receiver. So that might be a good choice. Nobody yet to report in on their experiences with the Alpine. I would think if you've already got an Alpine head unit, it would just be a natural to just use the Alpine aftermarket. Will Wheeler sends via email to leo@techguylabs.com. He wants to point out, we've been talking a little bit about Verizon and their high-speed wireless card. He says Verizon caps its Evdo usage at 5 gigabytes a month. I hadn't heard this. They advertise it as unlimited. He says they'll cancel your account and charge you an early termination fee if you go over 5 gigabytes. He says a lot of people have complained about this on the evdoinfo.com website, evdoinfo.com. So that's a good thing to know if you are considering using one of the Verizon cards. A lot of companies have these secret limits. Comcast will do it on their broadband. They advertise unlimited, but they mean unlimited as long as you don't use too much. Unlimited as long as you're not, using it. And then you can use as much as you want, as long as you don't. So there are these kind of hidden caps. They don't publicize them. And frankly, I think that it's probably a case-by-case basis, I would guess. I don't know. I've heard the same thing about other companies, as I said, Comcast and Verizon. It's a good idea to go places like broadbandreports.com and read the forums there. If people have problems, they will, and that's the beauty of the web. You can't keep anything a secret. If a company is practicing a bad business practice like that, there's no way it's going to be secret. People will tell you on the internet. So there's a couple of sites you want to probably know about. One is Evdo, E-V-D-O, info, I-N-F-O.com. And the other is, and I do recommend this, broadbandreports.com. Really a great site. Their forums, very useful. In fact, Mike B., who's our chat, one of our chat moderators, is very active over there. He does a lot with them. Let's say hi to line three, Mark Cherry Valley, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
Excellent. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great, except I got this problem that's really got me totally stumped. Uh-oh. So,
all right.
I'm sure a smart guy like you will know what it is instantly.
You're putting me on the spot now. All right.
Well, I'm sorry.
All
okay.
Right. All right.
This has to do with my home network. I have three computers. I set them all up on a network, and it worked great. Everything was just perfect. And then I just changed out the hard drive in one of my computers, and now the computer that I changed out the hard drive to, I can still access the other computers,
but you can't get into.
But the other computers won't let me access this one.
It has nothing to do with changing the hard drive, of course, but at some point during that process, you change how Windows was set up. Probably it's the Windows firewall getting in the way. But whenever you have a system that can get out, mm-hmm. but people can't get into it, that's mm-hmm. security software. Firewalls act as one-way valves. They allow information out. They don't allow unsolicited information in. So just by the very fact that you can still see other computers, but they can't see you, that's telling me that on that computer, that one alone, you've got either the Windows firewall, zone alarm, some other security software, Norton Internet Security, something is blocking incoming requests. And so what I would suggest doing is disabling any of that stuff temporarily just to see which one it is. Once you figure that out, then you want to add exceptions that allow networking through it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Now, hey nerd, hey geek, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. I'm here every week at this time to talk about tech with you. I hope you'll tell your friends and come back. All during the week, you can hear more of many of my contributors and, of course, of me on our podcast network. Yes, I can't get enough. I just can't get enough. You know, Art Bell, after he does his radio show, he'll go on the ham band and start talking. I just use the internet for that. The podcast is at twit.tv, T-W-I-T.tv. Most of them are pre-recorded, although we do a live one on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern called Net at Night with Amber MacArthur. That's kind of fun. And we're going to try Twit Live this afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. East Coast time on TalkShoe.com. That's the service we use for those. It's kind of interesting to try it live. Usually when we do, we bring it to its knees. Radio is so much better at large audiences than the internet is. So we got a long way to go on that. But twit.tv for the rest of them. TWIT.TV. Back to the phones. Gary Sturgis, Mississippi, line four. Hello, Gary. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Man, it's great to actually get to talk to you live. I'm glad you all are on the XM.
Isn't that great? Channel 152. Yep.
It is fantastic. I've got a question for you. You've probably answered a million times over the years. I'm a weekend DJ. I've got 15,000 plus songs in various external hard drives, and I have software mixers where I can call up a song in a heartbeat, but inevitably I've got a bride or bride's mother or whoever, whatever event I've got coming up, wanting a song list of all of my songs.
Oh, boy.
There's got to be some software out there somewhere that will take the headers. You know, I have all of that, the listing of all my songs in the folder.
Yeah.
How can I turn that into good old-fashioned paper?
Do you have a Windows machine or a Mac? How are you?
I'm running them all on Windows XP machine.
I'm thinking, I'm going to look and see, but I'm thinking a program, free program called Media Monkey will do it for you. This is an amazing, yeah, it will. I'm just looking at it right now. This is an amazing program, highly recommended. You can use it instead of iTunes because it integrates with iPods. It'll synchronize with your iPod. It allows you to look up and tag, put album art, organize, manage. It says it can manage 50,000 songs or more. How many do you have?
About 15,000.
Oh, you should be able to handle those. It will also create playlists and I presume print those playlists. But I mean, this is the most capable program I know of in this category. I'll certainly ask for other suggestions. And let me know if this worked for you. You can email me, leo@techguylabs.com. And if it doesn't, I'll see if I can find something else for you. But, boy, I don't know of any program that does more than this one. It's amazing.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's say hi to Lonnie, Line 1, California City, California.
Hi, Leo.
Hi, Lonnie.
I'm having a problem with Mozilla Firefox.
What's that nasty program doing to you now?
Oh, it looks like I'm getting hijacked.
Oh, dear.
The screen becomes slow, and an image with two arrows and a circle shows up. And what can I do to stop it?
Is it any particular website that does that for you, or is it just in general?
No, it's in general. When I'm using Mozilla Firefox, I deleted the old one, thinking it was just the problem with that one. And then
so tell me a little bit about what happens. You'll go, you'll launch Mozilla, or rather Firefox. You'll launch Firefox.
Yeah.
And the first page come up okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you'll start surfing around.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, it just stops working.
Yeah. All of a sudden, I see the screen and everything becomes slow, and an image with two arrows and a circle, like the ones from Sleep Number. That image shows up, and then all of a sudden I click off to get offline real quick.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about something bad happening at this point. I think that something else is going on. Do you see any text on that page when you see the circles in the arrow?
No, it all of a sudden does that to my screen.
Oh, the whole screen does it?
Yeah.
Not just the browsers? Not just the window, the whole screen now suddenly. And I'm trying to imagine this two circles in the arrow. You say it looks like what?
The symbol for the Sleep Number bed.
Wow. Is it actually the same symbol or just similar to?
The same symbol, the identical symbol.
I would say that sounds like you might have some spyware on your system.
Yeah, and I'm using already McAfee Security Center.
Oh, those things are worthless. You know, I'll be honest with you, and as I've said this before, they're a form of security, but really it's your behavior that's more important. And the minute you get spyware on your system, and I have to say this does, well, I can't tell. Does the system become unresponsive when you see this symbol?
Yes, it does.
Chat room, I'm asking the chat room, have you seen this image before, this Sleep Number selector? So it's a round circle with an arrow pointing up and an arrow pointing down.
Correct.
And how big is the circle?
It is maybe about a quarter of an inch or so.
That's not too big. And is the screen behind it white, black? What's going on there?
No, it's my standard, whatever I've been on that picture at that time.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden it'll just go slow, and then that'll show up.
Then that pops up. See, I'm not sure. Oh, I know what that is. I know what that is. That is, do you have a three-button mouse with a scroll wheel in the middle there?
Yes.
When you click that scroll wheel, you get that selector. What that is a way for you to scroll up and down or sideways, right and left on the page. It's a feature of Mozilla.
I'm not using that.
I know, but you're accidentally pressing it. When you get that button again, press the scroll wheel one more time. It'll go away and you'll be able to surf normally again.
Okay.
I think that's what it is. Now that you describe it, I'm starting to see that image in my head. It's a special feature, the scroll wheel and Firefox, that if the page is a certain size, you can use the scroll wheel to move around up and down on it by just moving the mouse up and down. If you get that, press the button again in the middle of the scroll wheel again, and it'll turn it off, and everything should be back to normal. It's not spyware. I think you're okay.
Oh, appreciate
that. Good news, Lonnie.
Okay.
Hey, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Take care. I thank all of you for joining us, for listening. We'll be back next week with more of our experts. We're going to get a gaming expert on the show, too. She's going to be great. Veronica Belmont. We got some great stuff ahead. Please come back again. Have a great week. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Happy computing.
Bye-bye and bye bonds.
That's good. I like that. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.